Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, what a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com. 111-110. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and I have with me today one of our Street Cop survivors, Mikhail Brookshire. But he's got a crazy story to tell, and we are always thankful that these men and women in law enforcement come on this podcast to share their stories. He was involved in a significant incident where he sustained a gunshot. He'll tell you all about this stuff, but without further ado, thank you on behalf of the law enforcement community today for being here, my friend. And it's good to see you again. Yeah.
Yep. Thank you for having me. It's been a blessing working with Street Cop, man. I had never even heard of Street Cop until one of my friends actually nominated me to go to the Street Cop conference for you guys. You guys selected me. And yeah, man, it's a great thing to be a part of. I'm glad that happened.
Tell me about that. How'd you like, your friend told you about it. What'd he say?
Well, he surprised me. He sent you guys the nomination and told my story, and he didn't tell me a thing about it. But when you guys selected me and he received an email saying that I had been selected, he sent me an email and kind of spilled the beans. It was a big surprise. I had never heard of the Street Cop Conference in my life, and I didn't even know what to make of it. And I thank him dearly to this day. He just celebrated his 30th birthday about a month or two ago, and I went to celebrate with him, and I thanked him profusely for it.
What did you think of the conference, dude? I'm glad you got to come to the whole thing.
Dude, man, it's an amazing training. I recommend every cop to go at least once during your career. More if you can, but go at least one time.
Like, what did it do for you personally, do you think? Like,
everything from mental health. Like, you walk out of that training more mentally healthy than you walked in. There's nothing like being around a group of people from all over the world, not just your agency or not just, you know, neighboring agencies, but literally all over the country that have been in your shoes, want the same things you want, and you can learn from these people. You can exchange ideas. Like, you definitely go in a lot more mentally healthy than you do, or you definitely come out more mentally healthy than you do going in. And this job, that's important, because this job takes a toll on your mental health. Like, that's really important. You're just as mentally healthy as physically healthy. But other than that, even if you're already a mentally healthy person, there's still just some good information. Like, you learn so much. I learned a lot just by going there, things that I wouldn't have known if I didn't go. And that's another thing about this job. You should always be looking for, you know, new knowledge. And Street Cop definitely offers that.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. We were honored to be able to, show our appreciation to you. And I'm glad that you received it well. So tell us about, you can give a vague description of who you are, your bio.
So yeah, I'm Mikhail Brookshire. I was born in Virginia, raised in Tennessee. 31 years old, married. Family, all that good stuff. I became a police officer at the age of 22. It was something I always wanted to do. I decided when I was about 15 years old that that's what I wanted to do with my life. So I was like asking local police officers what you have to do to be a cop, or is there anything that could help me with my resume when I become old enough to apply? And I used to talk about it all the time. And people who knew me back then, they're friends with me on Facebook, and they're like, oh man, I remember you always talking about you wanting to be a police officer. Now look at you out there saving the world. So yeah, it's an amazing thing. That's my general background.
So we're here today to talk about, you know, the incident that unfolded, to try to pull apart what we can to learn, to prevent, to try to understand and explore the mindset of what you could expect if it does happen to you. These are always great episodes for everybody to listen to, because I think they get a lot of value out of them. And I got a funny feeling your story and your dynamic and the way that you talk is going to be very insightful for most people. So how many years were you on the job before this incident unfolded?
Seven.
So why don't you just tell us what happened and we'll go through that.
Okay. So St. Patrick's Day, 2020, I'll never forget the date. When you go through something like this, the date gets ingrained in your head and it becomes an anniversary for you, so to speak. So March 17, 2020, I just signed on. My very first call of the day was a shots fired call, active shooter. I get there, and by the time I got there, the shooter had holstered his weapon, which was, I found kind of weird. So I go, I have my rifle deployed and in my hand, I'm walking towards the guy. When I make contact with him to get his attention, as soon as he sees me, he unholsters the weapon. I try to fire at him with the rifle, but the gun jammed. And at that moment, my life flashed before my eyes because the distance between me and him, I'm like, he's going to get the first shot off and he's not going to miss. Like, he's too close. So he got the first shot off, and that first shot went straight to my head.
Wow.
Yeah. Thankfully, it didn't penetrate the skull. It started right here at about the front of my head, and then got about right hand, kind of just bounced off my skull. My mom always told me I had a hard head, and I guess she wasn't kidding. I blinked for a second. I thought I was dead. But after blinking once or twice and realizing that I wasn't dead, I'm like, wait, I'm still in this fight. Okay. I retreated to cover. And one thing they teach in the academy here, they teach you shot does not mean dead. And that started kind of ringing in my head repeatedly. The word shot does not mean dead. Shot does not mean dead kept ringing in my head. And I was like, you know, I'm not dead. So I retreated to cover. I cleared the jam from my rifle. And then a moment later, the guy that shot me was dead. I had to take him out.
So you were able to clear the jam out of the rifle?
Yes.
How did jam? What kind of jam happened?
What ended up happening was I didn't properly seat the magazine in the well. So the jam was operator error. It was my fault. High stress situation. You know, I should have had that done before I even got to the call. So that's 100% on me. And it almost cost me my life. But
so you guys carry your rifles not charged?
Yes. We have to carry them. That's what's called patrol ready mode. And the patrol ready mode is not charged. No.
But you, the magazine was in. You just got to charge it to get ready to fight, right?
Correct. But since it was my first call of the day, I hadn't even put it in patrol ready mode. Like I said, I just signed on. So actually, at the time I got that call, it was still just in the rifle bag. No magazine in it. None of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was very much caught off guard. And so when I put it in, since I was kind of, again, you know, stressful, I ended up not seating it properly. You know, so when I tried to charge it, you know, the bullet
charge around.
Right.
What's the lesson learned there, right? Like, what do you think about that?
Since then, I've been repeating the words, you know, stay ready so that you don't have to get ready. If I had been ready, the situation, I mean, it still couldn't have been completely prevented, but I wouldn't have got shot in the head. You know, that part could have been prevented if I had been ready.
Like a simple mistake almost costs your life. Exactly. Something very, very, very simple that maybe a lot of us take an oversight of when we go into patrol and not think about what is my equipment? Where is it? Is it ready? What do I have at my disposal? What if I face this? What am I going to do?
Right.
Were you playing a lot of these scenarios in your head prior to this incident unfolding?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Because, I mean, like I said, the call came up with the shots fired. So I'm going to this call already in that, you know, what if, what could happen mode. There's so much goes through your mind at that moment. On the way to the call, I'm like, is anybody already hurt? You know, who is he shooting at? Why is he shooting at people? Is this another one of those mass shooting situations that we've been hearing about on the news lately? It was just so much going through my head. Amazingly enough, he hadn't hurt anybody by the time I got there. It was all property damage. As I'll never to this day really understand what that guy's motive was. The only people he actually ended up shooting were the officers. He shot me and another officer, me in the head, and then the officer who was with me got shot in the foot.
What kind of gun was he firing?
I don't know the make and model, but I remember it was a 9mm. I just remember the bullet. It was a 9mm. I don't remember the make and model. I don't think they ever even told me. I didn't bother asking. My mind was on so many other things.
So you get shot in the head. You take your rifle out. You see him coming at you. You try to squeeze around off. You realize it's not working. It's a malfunction. He gets his shot off, hits you in the head. You realize that you're okay, nonetheless, in some capacity. You're still in the fight. Retreat to cover. Clear the jam. You just did training kick in to tap the bottom of that thing and rack that thing and get it going?
Oh, yes, most definitely. When you're in a stressful situation, your body naturally reverts to your training. You don't think about anything that you do. Everything you do is all natural. And that's why it's so important to, once you have some kind of training, repetitions are important because you want that to be your muscle memory. Because when you're in that situation, you are not consciously thinking about anything that you're doing. Everything your body does, it's all muscle memory. Everything that you've been repeating, your habits, that's what your body results to because you don't consciously think about it. As a matter of fact, I don't even remember most of it. Like I only remember the most important details. When I had to do my internal interview, they were asking me questions about small details that I literally didn't remember. I had to tell them that when they were doing the interview, I was like, I don't remember doing that. So if you're asking me why I did something, I can't tell you why I did it because I literally don't remember doing it. They eventually, after the interview was over, they let me watch the body camera footage and half of it I didn't remember. I was like, I don't remember doing that. I don't remember doing that. Most of it I didn't remember.
So I don't know if I can get to the details of it, but like once you charge this rifle, you get back up. Where is he at this point?
At this point, he's about 75 yards away from me. And I learned that after the fact because they did from where my rifle shells were to where his body was laying. They did the measurements. So at this point, I'm behind a telephone pole about 75 yards away from him. And he's in the middle of the street, literally, like in the middle of the street, in the middle of the road. And he's yelling at me and still firing. I'm not sure what he's saying. I can't really make out what he's saying from 75 yards away, but he's yelling at me. He's still firing. He's actually taunting me. Like as he's yelling at me, like he'll fire a couple of rounds. Then he would like do a little dance and then he'll fire him while he's taunting me. It's almost like he wanted me to shoot him. I don't know if it was a suicide by police. It was very much like he wanted me to shoot him, just provoking me. And then he was so motivated because when I first shot him, he went to the ground and I thought it was over. And at that point, I'd only shot him like twice. So at this point, I'm thinking it's over. I start approaching him. As I get close to him, though, I realize he still has the gun in his hand. So I stop approaching. I'm like, I'm not going to get any closer. He starts firing at me from the ground.
Holy shit.
And I'm like, this guy is like, you want me to shoot you some more? And I'm begging him at this point, drop the gun, drop the gun, drop the gun. Let's end this. He doesn't want to end it. So he's still shooting at me. So I shoot him a few more times. Then at this point, backup starts arriving. And he decided he was finished with me. He turned his back to me while on the ground and started shooting at the backup officers. So I shot him some more. And finally, one of the backup officers that were on the other side had started flailing their arms and saying, hey, cease fire, cease fire. That was the way of saying, like, he's finished. He's done. He had stopped doing whatever he was doing.
So you're firing 223 at him?
Yes.
And did you have, what kind of sights were you using?
The red dot sights.
Okay, so red dot sights. You didn't have iron sights. You actually had red dot sights. You're trying to sight them in.
All right.
What about, do you have to dial those down or dial them up based on the condition, or is that ready to go?
That was ready to go. I keep my red dot sights ready. Now, when I zeroed the rifle, when I first was issued the rifle, I zeroed it using the iron sights. And then after zeroing the rifle to my, you know, then that's when they put the red dot sights on.
We had a guy that I interviewed one time, and it's a long time ago, that the optic that he was using prevented him from firing the weapon. Wow. So it's important for people to think about that. And I don't want to hold that in, and I want to share it with everybody that you really got to consider what extra steps you need when you have a weapon regarding the optic and getting it adjusted to the environment that you're in. So you may want to really be able to defer to those iron sights right away. And I'm not a gun guy. I have some stuff. Right? I have some stuff that I've never even shot. I just wanted to own it. But, you know, this is the stuff that I'm just repeating it. I'm not saying here and trying to fire people up or the gun people who are adamant about weapons, maybe saying, I don't know what I'm talking about. This is all I was told. That's all I'm saying. That's what I was told by a guy that he could not get this shooter that was shooting at him dialed in on his rifle sights. When you're gun jammed, did you ever think about transitioning to your sidearm?
I did actually. Because I didn't immediately clear the jam. It actually took a minute because I had to figure out why I jammed in the first place. So when I first tried to clear the jam, it still didn't work. So I shot about two rounds at him with my sidearm, but I was just too far away.
Okay.
I'm not going to hit him from this far. So I kind of gave up on that. And I was like, okay, I have to get this rifle working.
Did you reholster your weapon, then get to the rifle?
I didn't. And that's actually one of the questions that they were asking me in my internal interview that I didn't remember because I was, so I'm behind the telephone pole for cover, but right next to me, there's a stone wall that's almost my height. When I gave up on my sidearm, I actually sat my pistol on the side, I set my sidearm on the stone wall that's like about almost eye level with me to fight with my rifle. And they asked me, they were like, well, why didn't you just reholster? But I didn't remember doing that. I only know that I did that because they let me watch my body camera footage. If it wasn't for that, I have no recollection of actually doing that. So I was like, I can't tell you why I did that because I don't remember doing that. Like,
it's very interesting what people don't understand about going through a situation like this and what you know, the accountability behind it is What would you like me to do? Right. I'm fighting for my life right now. Exactly. And I'm not trying to make sense policy wise of everything that's going on. You know, once we're in a gun battle, I feel like it's all off the fucking table, minus the fact that you don't want to hurt innocent people. Exactly. Outside of that, like, bro, you rip the fucking guy's jaw off with your hands if you have to. You know what I mean? Like, exactly. You're going to die. And brother, I mean, you know, I'm fortunate enough to not have to have gone through something like that in my career. I can't imagine what that's like to go through that. So you dial in, you hit this guy twice. He drops, but he's still on the ground. He's got his hand on the gun. And then he's going for the gun. He starts shooting. You hit him a few more times. You were landing those shots. Did you miss any shots?
Not a single one.
Why do you think that is? Were you practicing with that rifle?
Oh, yeah. That's like my baby. That's my, of all the, I've owned a total of 5 guns, and that's my favorite one. Just like how you were saying, why you say you have guns that you've never even shot, I have one as well. I got an M4 that I've never even shot. But that particular one, that was a Psyonix AR-15. And I feel like I'm married to that gun. That is my baby. Like, I would not miss with that thing. That's my baby.
So it's important, man, to like know your weapon and practice with it, right?
Right, of course.
How often are you shooting with that gun?
Oh, man, literally every time I would go to the range, I make it a point to go at least quarterly because, you know, we have requalifications every year. But sometimes I'll go even more than that. Like my wife has gotten into shooting. So we would go for like date nights and things like that. And every time I go, I make it a priority to shoot that particular one. Like we might dibble and dabble with the other ones just for fun, but that's like kind of my go-to. That's the one where I'm like, if I'm in a situation where I have to either defend something or do anything, like that's what I want in my hand. Like I'm so proficient with that thing. And I had gotten a lot of compliments when they did the measurement. They were like, man, you hit that guy from almost a football field away. And I was like, dude, I don't miss with that thing.
Wow.
I just don't. I just can't. So, yeah, I hit him a total of 9 times and I shot a total of 9 rounds. Like
you did. Attaboy.
Yeah.
Attaboy. That's nice. It's great to hear the good guy won, protecting the people of your city. You know, it's super just, I think probably everybody's so fucking proud of you. Right. You did exactly what you came to do, bro. You
know? Yeah, I got a lot of accolades and things for that. And they say it's well deserved, but honestly, at the time it didn't really feel like it. Like I didn't really know what to make of it, honestly. It really does something to you mentally. Like I was like, I don't know what to make. I didn't feel like a hero, honestly. Even if I was, I didn't feel like one.
I think a lot of people who go through things like this and receive accolades, I think because of their mindset of selflessness, and I'm going to put myself in the category of a similar mindset. I don't deserve anything close to what you did and recognition in that sense. But yeah, I'm real hard at receiving. I accept and acknowledge compliments,
right?
But like, they don't go to the brain. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh yeah, here I am, folks. Like bow, like you know, I go to places still, and it's very interesting. I go to some events and I'll have people want my autograph and take pictures and all this. And then I go to other events and I don't even know if people are like, don't know who I am. And I always tell the story. It's funny. Cause like, I'll see a group of people like looking at me and I'm like, I wonder if they know who I am, but they just don't want to say anything. And then like, maybe I should try to break the ice. And I go, I'm like, hey Dennis. They're like, yeah, I'm fucking Joe. This is Pete. Like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Like you on a job. I'm like, I retired. And they're like, oh, cool. You know? And then sometimes I go over and they're like, well, we wanted to talk to you, dude, but like, we didn't want to fucking say this guy over here wants to do things to you. Like, you know, it's just a big joke. So, you know, I understand about receiving awards and things like that, how it's probably a little uncomfortable because you're just doing who you are, bro.
Right. Exactly. It was very personal for me. I told everybody in that situation, I wasn't operating as Officer Brookshire. I was operating as Mikhail Brookshire. It was very personal. It wasn't anything professional about that situation. Everything was personal.
So you're hit. Do you think you have a bullet in your head?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What's next?
I literally thought I was dead. I kind of had already felt it. It's almost like, I anticipated death the moment my rifle jammed. Like, the only person that would have ever saw it was the guy, because he was the only person that was looking directly at my face. Looking at it through body camera footage is different. He probably saw the look on my face and he probably knew that I thought I was dead. The moment my rifle didn't fire, I kind of lowered it a little bit and my eyes kind of got big, like, oh my God, this is it for me. This is the last thing I'm going to see. And then people don't believe me when I say this. I literally saw the bullet. They're like, oh, no, bullets are too fast. No, I saw the bullet coming at me. And it's, it happens in a book.
I believe that.
It's almost like slow motion. I saw the end of that bullet and I saw it was coming. And I was like, I'm not going to survive this. Then I felt it hit my head. I didn't get that. A lot of people have like high adrenaline where they don't feel something until later on. Like in fact, the officer that was with me, they got shot in the foot, didn't realize he was shot in the foot until he got back to the precinct. Because the adrenaline, right, the adrenaline was so high. Me, I didn't get that. Like I didn't have that luxury. I felt that bullet go across the top of my head. And the way I described the feeling, imagine if somebody took like a curling iron or a hot comb and rubbed it across the top of your head. That's what it felt like.
Wow.
Because it's hot. It's really hot. It's like somebody, So when I felt that bullet going in my head, I was like, dude, I'm for sure dead. And I felt the bullet leave my head. And I'm thinking at this point, it's in my brain. That's what I'm thinking. And that's why I'm not feeling anything. And it took me about three blinks to realize that I was alive. After about that third blink, I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I'm actually still here. I started like, I even tested it a little bit. Like I kind of like flailed my arms a little bit. I'm like, oh, wait, I'm actually still alive. And I immediately, like, so I retreated. I actually turned my back to the guy, which is not a good idea. I don't recommend doing that. But I was in such a panic state. I was like, I just got to get some distance between me and him because we're so close. He could easily shoot me again. And he's still firing. So like, I completely turned my back to the guy and I take off in a full sprint running away from him. And I still hear gunshots behind me. I don't know where they are. If one of them's going to hit me, I'm just, I'm like, I need to get away from this guy. So yeah, that's kind of what it's like to get shot in the head. Like you think you're dead for a moment and then you're thankful that you're not. And then you realize, well, wait, you know, if I wanted to stay that way, I got to get back in this or else I will be. So
everybody starts showing up. I'm sure you're bleeding, right?
Yeah.
What do you tell your coworkers? I've been hit. Get me somewhere fast.
I actually said on the radio before they got there, before they even arrived, I said on the radio that I've been shot in the head. And I guess I did that kind of intentionally to let them know that I'm still coherent. So I didn't want anybody to get there and think that I was no longer coherent. So it's like, when you get here, you heard me on the radio screaming, I've been shot in the head. You are aware that I'm aware that I've been shot in the head. Because one thing that kind of, it kind of pissed me off. I got tired of hearing, dude, you're so lucky. I got tired of hearing that. Like it got really old, really fast. By the time the EMTs got there, I had already heard that from about four of my coworkers. The EMT is checking on my head and I felt him about to say it. And I said, dude, just don't say it. Like, I'm already tired of hearing it. I'm already kind of mentally going through it because believe me, I've already gone through the mental process of how lucky I am that I'm not dead. And it's like, I don't need to hear that repeatedly from everybody who looks at me from this point forward. So that was kind of frustrating. So like they saw it and that's what everybody just kept on saying, dude, you're so lucky, man. You got angels looking out for you, man. You're so lucky. You're so lucky. And I'm like, dude, you don't think I know that already? I knew that before you arrived on scene. Like, let's not keep harping on that. Mm-hmm. That was actually one of the things that made it hard to mentally get past it. Cause like, as a police officer, you understand what you're signing up for. And it's like, okay, you never want to have to do that to anybody. You never want to have to shoot anybody. However, you understand the possibility. So I'm fine with that. I'm fine with the fact that, you know, I was one of the unlucky ones that had to encounter such a situation. But I had a hard time mentally getting past the whole one more inch thing. I'm like, if I was just an inch taller, I'd be dead, literally. I just had my son at that time. He was 4 months old at the time. And the thought of him having to grow up without me had kept ringing through my head. And it's very easy to say things like, oh, well, you know, just try to make peace with the fact that that didn't happen. You know, you're still here. You still get to see your son. I'm like, that's so easy to say. But there's a mental block that gets created by that whole what if scenario. And it's very, very hard to get over that mental health. It really is. It took, you know, months of therapy, the street cop training, all of those things played a part in, you know, me getting past that mental block, that what if the bullet was just an inch lower, or what if I was just an inch taller, or, you know.
How do you see the world differently now?
I am a lot, and I hate to say this, but I got to be honest. The truth is, ever since that day, I've been a lot quicker to resort to violence than I ever have been in my life. It made me very edgy. I guess I don't see the world itself any differently, but my personality has definitely changed. I'm a lot darker than I once was. Like, I'm still a fun person to be around. Like, I'm not like a Debbie Downer or anything. People still love being around me. They still love my energy. That's never going to change. But I'm just a lot more defensive than I once was, a lot quicker to resort to violence than I once was. yeah, I just have a much more edgy personality now.
Are you still trying to find therapeutic solutions to try to calm down the hyper awareness?
Yes. And honestly, it never ends. Like when something like that happened, it sticks with you. It doesn't go away. You kind of just learn how to find healthy ways to live with it, but it never actually goes away. It definitely sticks with you. And I explain to people that when you're in a situation like that, it's going to affect everybody differently. However, it's going to affect you. I tell people, don't think you're ever going to go through a situation like that and not be affected. It may not affect you the same way it affected, you know, another person, because it's going to affect everybody differently, but it is going to affect you. So while I can't tell you exactly how it's going to affect you, I can tell you that if you go through that, it's going to affect you. Your personality is going to change. Something about you is going to change. You're not going to come out of that situation the same person you were going in. It's just, it's not realistic.
How many kids do you have?
I have one biological and two stepchildren, bonus children. So, and of course I treat them just like my biologicals anyway. So I have three children.
How has this impacted the way you see your children or interact with your children?
It's made me a whole lot more nurturing, which I already was naturally that way. But it's like, you know, you learn to worship time. My outlook on time has definitely changed. I used to be the kind of guy that, like I said, you know, working for the department that I work for, one of the things that make me stay is the amount of, you know, money that you can make working here, because you have all these overtime opportunities plus, like, you know, side work opportunities. And I used to kind of, you know, capitalize on that stuff because I wanted to give my kids everything. But then I realized the most valuable thing that I could give them is just time at home. So I actually quit a lot of the side work that I was doing. I gave a lot of it up just so I could have more time at home with them, you know.
That is a very powerful statement.
Oh, yeah. I took a major pay cut and I don't even care. Like, you know, it was worth it.
You are not alone in fathers who were police officers who were shot in the line of duty who say the same exact thing. The one thing they learned the most out of this is that time with their kids were more important. And when they made time, they didn't mean I'm watching the football game, he's playing in the other room. Right. It's time together. And as a father of many children myself, I try my best to be conscious of accounting for my time with them and what that means. Is it important to them? The kind of like, dude, right now, and I'm kind of smiling. You could, if you read body language, I'm seeing myself on the video. The other night, my kids have been asking me to set up split screen Fortnite for them, right? Because they're younger, but they play Fortnite.
Right.
And after I finally figured it out, I sat there, I'm gonna take a half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever it takes to get this thing figured out. I'm busy. I sat them there with them and watched them play Fortnite for about 2 hours, and they had me dying laughing. I mean, I was cracking up. The personalities, these kids coming out talking shit to each other next to each other. I mean, they 6 and 8 years old. I mean, I was dying. And the next day I came home and they said, can we play Fortnite again tonight? And I went up 100%. It was one of the best moments of my life. And it's so interesting that we think we have to create this amazing life. And sometimes what we got to do is just be there with them and for them and enjoy it with them. And then my oldest is like, you want to play Fortnite with me? I'm like, you're going to be embarrassed. Like I don't touch game consoles because I don't want to get, you know, I get obsessive. So we had PS4. We got it during the pandemic. Uh-huh. And so my kid's like, can you play Spider-Man for us? Yeah. Unfortunately, Spider-Man began to take over my life. And then I realized there was a Spider-Man 2, the Miles Morales version. And that began to take over my life. I beat both games, but I had to actually dial it in to only do an hour a night. My wife's like, yo, you know, I said, this is why I don't touch video games. I can't stop them once I start playing them. So I was, I was doing like 1 hour a night, sticking to it, then shutting the console up. But I had to finish it at this point. I just was getting too good at this game. And I actually really enjoyed it too. But so I'm very hesitant to grab that. But, you know, I hear that all the time. What kind of comfort do you find in your children now?
Oh, man.
Pure, right? Isn't it just pure?
It's unexplainable. Like when I talk about like the pay cut that I took, and I'm like, dude, it just goes to show how valuable it is, because I literally did not care about all that money that I lost out of. Like, that's the first time in my life I think I ever didn't care about money. It was crazy. I'm like, time is the most valuable resource. And I have a very wise friend that was kind of helping me through the mental process. And what he told me was, he said, nobody in this world has ever been old and on their deathbed and said, I wish I had more money. That's never happened. Everybody, when they get to that point, they always say, I wish I had more time. I wish I had spent my time doing this or doing that. They never look back and be like, oh, well, I wish I had more money, or I wish I would have made more money. It's always, I wish I would have spent more time getting to know this person or spending more time with this person. It's always time. Time is the one resource you can't get more of. I can get more money, I can't get more time.
I am trying to make sure that on my deathbed, hopefully at a very old age, I don't have regrets.
Exactly.
You know, what can I say? You play the best you can. Right. As long as you play with a good heart and good intentions and didn't play dirty, you know, what you're just trying to play every day as the game changes.
Right.
You know, what's the most valuable thing to do with your time? It's the one thing that they don't make more of and you don't get more of.
Right. That's literally what life really is. They say life's not a game, but I'm like, it kind of is when you think about it. It really is.
Well, you know, I think there's lessons to be learned. And unfortunately, I'm thankful that it's not me, but there are people in my life right now who are dealing with some serious conditions that could be essentially terminal. And I'm like, God damn, like we're the same age to be staring death in the face all at such a young age to just 40. You know what I mean? Like, or even younger than that, not even getting a shot. Everybody's just convinced they're going to live till they're 95, 100 years old. But my grandmother said to me before she passed away, when she was still well, I said, what does it feel like to be, maybe she was 75. And she said, I just can't believe it. She goes, I can't believe that I am this old. She said, I had wonderful times with a lot of my friends. I had a wonderful life. She said, I swear to you, I cannot believe I'm 75 years old. I still can't wrap my head around where all this time went. And one thing I hear about continuously, and I heard this a few years ago, heard it from my next door neighbor. I was hearing it over and over again. I know in the world speaking to me, they talked about, my neighbor said, you know, I was working like 19 hours a day for the first 10 years of these kids' lives. And it was a mistake. He said, we got what we got, but it was a mistake. And I should have been there more. I could have been there more. And I just thought this was what I was supposed to do. And I can't go back and do that again. I don't get that time back. So I think about that tremendously, dude. And I'm like, street cop training could be doing 30 to 40% more this year than we're doing. But I don't get an opportunity to spend the time with my family and people that mean a lot to me ever again in my life. And if I got diagnosed with something tomorrow, at least I could say, glad I decided not to go for 40% more, because we're good. You know what I mean? We're good. I'm happy.
And that's exactly how I feel about it. My life was work at one point. It was like work travel. Cause like, again, I was making a lot of money. So what I would do is I would make a crap ton of money and then I would book a vacation. That was literally my life. And then when I had my son, it was, I'm putting money away in his savings account. I'm like, I'm preparing him for college. And I felt like I was doing the right thing. I'm like, as a father, that's what I should be doing. But I was like, you know what? When he turns 18, I would much rather, even if I have no money in his college savings or anything like that, I would much rather say that I spent the last 18 years with him than to have $100,000 in his college savings, but I never saw him the whole 18 years. Like, that just didn't sit right with me.
I think people need to toy with the balance of, do I actually need more, or is this what I actually need more of?
Exactly.
I don't realize like the importance of having good, strong relationships. There's a TED talk that I've talked about this on other podcasts that I'm trying to take in TED Talks every morning if I have the time. And what they found is that they studied these 1,000+ men and started interviewing women later on as well, is that the ones who lived the longest had the best relationships. Loneliness and bad relationships that killed people early, more contrary to what people believe. What kept people alive the longest.
And that goes back into the mental health thing. I'm like, people who have good relationships, they are happy. They are mentally healthy and they are happy. I'm like, and that's why they live longer. Your body, you have a stronger immune system. You are naturally stronger when you are happier and healthier, as opposed to somebody who's in low spirits all the time. That literally takes a toll on like your immune system. You're going to get sick easier, sick faster. Like, you know, we've witnessed people beat cancer just by being happy. Like, we've all saw that happen before. And that's all it takes. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to be that guy with, no friends, no, you know, not close with my children because they never really saw me growing up. I don't want my children's memory of me to be, well, dad was always at work. I mean, yeah, we had all the latest gaming systems and fancy things, but dad was always at work. I don't want that to be my kids' growing up experience.
How old are your kids, if you don't mind sharing?
Oh, no, absolutely. 13, 9, and he's 2, but he'll be 3 this November.
What kind of gaming systems do they have?
All of them.
Okay.
Because the thing is, I'm a gamer too, though. So that's
okay, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. We got the Nintendo Switch, the PS5, the Xbox One X, whatever they call this new one. Mm-hmm. We got all of that. Because I'm an avid gamer myself. That's actually one of my mental releases. That's my escape from the real world. I spend a lot of my free time playing video games. I'm a nerd. I'm into like those Japanese RPGs. So I'm like Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest. Those are the kind of games I play. My kids, they play Roblox. And I'm not really into Roblox, but I'll play for them. Like I'll play with them just to play with them. They beat me at all the games and I'm fine with that. Because for me, it's just about like, you know, they care about actually winning or losing the game. Me, they don't know. They don't realize, like, I'm doing this just so I can have this time with you. They don't realize that. But I'm like, that's why I'm playing this game, just to have this time with you.
You should give my kids tonight and talk shit to them on Fortnite. Yeah, I think it's comical to hear how these kids talk. And like, look, man, you could try to put earmuffs over your kids' ears in today's day and age. It ain't like that. There's just too much technology. So I
gave up on that. I literally gave up. I'll try to censor my kids from all this stuff. But my 13-year-old, as he's getting older, I'm like, he's going to get exposed to more. So I started being like a little more laid back about the things that I let him watch and indulge in. So he has a TikTok now. And when I saw that TikTok, I was just like, you know what? Forget it. It's one of those things where you're going to hear it regardless. As long as you know what's right and what's wrong, you know how to talk to me, how not to talk to me. I can live with that. Fine. Mm-hmm. Because every TikTok is going to drop an F-bomb or something. I'm like,
oh, it's, you know, wild.
Yes, whatever.
My kid last night tells the other kid, the oldest one tells the 6-year-old. He goes, I'm going to, because their mother's not around and she hears this, she'd have a fit. But he goes, I'm going to beat the shit out of you. And brother, I should have stepped in and said something. I lost it. I was like, man, that's. Then the other one starts cursing to try to make me laugh. I went, guys.
It's like you want to, but it's hard to because you're laughing at the same time. It's hard to be taken.
Yeah, I was dying. This one, they got me off guard by saying that. And you know, then my son said to me, well, how come you get to say this? I said, I'm an adult. He goes, you say that all the time. Because I tell him all the time, I'm beat this shit. Like a joking around. I don't hit my kids. I don't find it necessary to. I'm a good communicator, and they're terrified of their mother. But we both don't hit our children. And I subscribe to the fact that I know that you don't have to hit your kids if you're parenting properly. You can say what you want. You have the right to do whatever you want to do, right? They're your kids, but I know my kids are some of the best kids you'll ever meet. They're fun. They're all all of them right across the board are funny as fuck. I'm sure it's hard to believe if you watch my stand-up routine at the fucking conference. I was on fire at the conference, though. Let's keep it real.
Yeah, you were. You absolutely were.
I was crushing. I had a 5 days. I didn't miss, bro.
You did not.
They're funny. Their mother's funny. I'm funny. So they're all very, very funny. You know, and we curse a lot. It's Jersey, you know.
We are. Yeah. Dude, that was actually like one of the highlights of my year doing the Street Cop Conference. And I did a lot last year. My wife and I went to Greece last year for her birthday. We went to Colombia for my birthday. We did the Cop Conference. And through everything we did, man, the Cop Conference, that was like the highlight of my year last year, man.
It was actually the best year of my life. I'm sorry, the best week of my life professionally. And contrary to popular belief, people start trying to do calculations of what the thing makes. We really didn't make any money on it. And that wasn't the point of it. And I told my staff here, we're not doing this to make money. That's not the point of this conference. Right. It's not we're here to honor these men and women. We're here to give good training. We're here to bring everybody together, collaborate. There's some brand building and marketing. And I think people got really acknowledged the powerhouse that we have become of putting an event on like that. But I couldn't put a dollar tag on what I got out of that week. You know, after we did the conference with you guys and did the ceremony where you were all honored and given the Street Cop Survivor Award, I went back to my room. I was tired already, but I laid in bed and cried for 3 hours. Like, not like in a good way. I think everybody in that room was crying as we were honoring you guys. And you had 1,000 of the most resilient, tough, hard-charged, driven, purposeful police officers in the country in there holding back tears and trying to get each other not to see one another cry because, bro, that energy in that room at that time, oof.
And that's the reason why I said I recommend every law enforcement officer go at least one time during their career, because the truth is, a lot of us don't have safe spaces like that. And when I saw that, I feel like, you know what? Most of these people that are in here doing that, this is the first time they feel like they've been in a safe space to do that since they got on the job. This is the first time this person next to me felt like they were in a safe space to be able to cry and like let it all out or say what they've been through. That's probably the first time they've had that. Like, and it's crazy. Like, we need so much more of that. That needs to be at every agency in some form or fashion. And that's one of the things that I commend my agency for, that they have that. They have a psych service and employee assistance program where you have that safe space to be able to do that. But everybody doesn't have that, and they need that as desperately. Like, one of the female law enforcement officers, like, you know, I'm outside, people are, you know, handshaking me, congratulating them, like, dude, man, your story was pretty badass and all that. And one of the female law enforcement officers, she came in, she hugged me. And she talked to me about how hard it is being a female in law enforcement, all the stereotypes and all the things like with that. And I could just tell, I'm like, she's never had an outlet to be able to talk like that before. And that was the first time she felt like she could. And I'm like, wow, it was amazing, man. It's amazing.
That's good. You know, we have, we're trying here every day. We're trying to, we have the right people coming forward. We have a course now with Lieutenant Heather Glogalich, who's a cop here, and she does a real strong program to acknowledge some of the stuff that women deal with and let them know they're not alone. And it's powerful. She's a very good speaker. I'm very proud to have her on our team. You know, I think we've covered a lot here, but I have questions, but I have one question I think that we could wrap with. And okay. I think you're probably going to answer this the best that anybody's ever answered it. I just got a funny fucking feeling.
Thank you.
It's a very general question, but what do you love the most about this profession?
Oh, that's a good one. I would say my favorite thing about this profession is the character development that you get from it. Like, this job grows you in a way that no other profession just ever could. It's just not, you know, this is the most rewarding profession in the world. There's no profession more rewarding than this. It may not be the one that pays the most. It may not even always be the most fun one, but you just can't beat the feeling that you get. The things that you see, the people that you get to help, the things that you learn so that you can better help, you know, others. It's like, you can't beat that. You know, you have your failures and they suck. There are times where I probably could have done a better job at helping somebody, but I didn't know how, but at least I was able to use those experiences to be able to better serve, you know, people going forward. I'm like, okay, you know what? I failed this person, that sucks. But the next time I encounter somebody like that person, you know, I'm better now equipped to serve that person. And so yeah, it's the character development and the growth. That's one thing that just, you can't get that anywhere else.
How do you feel about the people involved in this industry?
You mean like other law enforcement officers or?
Yeah, like what do you feel about, you feel the camaraderie, the brotherhood, the sisterhood? Tell me about that.
Most definitely. Again, safe space. I feel safer and more comfortable and everything when I'm around other members of law enforcement. Camaraderie is unmatched. And of course, nothing is ever 100% in this world. You're going to meet some that are just complete assholes for no reason. It is what it is. But overall, you know, they're really good people. Again, I feel my most safe, my most comfortable, my happiest whenever I'm around them for that exact reason. Not just because they're relatable, because they're really just great people. Like when I'm hanging out with my cop buddies, we, for the most part, don't even talk about cop stuff. We try to, you know, separate ourselves, like our personal lives from the job. And yeah, they're the most amazing people you'll meet. You know, if you can see us beyond the uniform and for the actual people that we are actually some of the most amazing people in this country.
That's why I asked you those questions, because that answer was probably the best one I'll ever get. And I think that probably a good point to end it on. One, because it was the best answer I ever imagined I get. And two, I'm going to pee my pants because I drank about 9 gallons of water this morning so far. So this is why the podcasts go for about as long as they do, because usually I have to urinate. But listen, man, I can't thank you enough. I feel so connected to you. I think you're just literally the prime example of what it means to be a cop. I don't know. And it's people like you who show up and take the time out of your day to do this, to restore faith in some of the people who are maybe dissuaded or down in the profession. And you are an example. There's no question about it.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to do this. And anything you need from me in the future, anything that I can be a part of, anything I can do to help, this here has probably been probably the best organization I've been a part of since I started my career in law enforcement, which was 10 years ago now. And man, I've never seen anything as well put together as this, and with as much to offer as this. I'm honored to be a part of this, man. And whatever I can do for you in the future, you can just let me know. I feel likewise connected to you.
What if, because we're going to honor a new group of guys and girls this in the upcoming event, April 23rd to 28th, 2023, in Nashville. Mark it off on your calendar.
I'm from Nashville. That's where I'm from.
Oh, that's perfect. We actually may need some people to help us run the conference. If you're down with that, like I can cover your expenses and stuff to get there. As long as you want to jump in and give us a hand and kind of like work with the company that week. I think that's cool.
Dude, absolutely. And it's perfect since it's in Nashville. So for me, that's literally just a trip home, really.
Okay, cool. We'll put that together. But you got to follow up with me. Make sure that we'll get your name on the board and we'll put you to work. But you're going to work. Right? No, we need help. I'm not saying I'm going to make you assemble stages, but like we'll need help with stuff. But I'd be honored to have you.
And that'd be a perfect reason, literally, for me to get on the books that year. I talked to my wife and we won't be doing as much traveling next year as we've done, you know, here in previous years. So that'd be the perfect reason. I'll take that week off and I'll shoot down home and, yeah, man, we can do that.
It's you're going to see. We'll get you a radio. You're going to see how chaotic the event really is behind the scenes.
Okay.
And you know, like I'm real easy to work with, but I am a perfectionist in the vision that I have and how I saw it. And we've got to try to one up last year. So I got some work to do.
All right.
You're the man, Mikhail. And I'll send you my cell number. Actually, I'll give it to you as soon as we cut, but thank you again for being here.
Absolutely.